be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Day of the African Child is coming to Portland in commemoration of the dozens of black South African children who were massacred in Soweto as they demonstrated for their rights.
We will have a live interview with Anita Rogers of the Mackenzie River Gathering, who will tell us about the exciting projects and programs funded by progressive organizations.
And a new Pew Research Center finds that the global image of America is on the decline.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 14th, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Amtrak bus service from Sacramento to Redding has been extended to Ashland and Medford, Oregon, with stops in Dunsmuir, Mount Shasta, Weed, and Yreka. The bus meets up with the Amtrak San Joaquin train that connects Sacramento and Los Angeles, with southbound stops from Lodi to Bakersfield. The San Joaquin line in 2005 was 771,409 passengers, a 3.2 decrease over the year before. The California corridors, operated under the partnership banner Amtrak California, are the busiest in the nation behind the Washington-Boston Northeast Corridor and the Empire Corridor serving Albany, New York City.
Dozens of Oregon religious leaders at the Capitol yesterday said that global warming is not just a problem for the obviously affected industries releasing carbon dioxide, people living in areas likely to be inundated by rising seas, or environmentalists worried about major global issues. The Energy Stewardship Meeting was presented in part by Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign, a project of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Dozens of other religious organizations and a handful of state legislators took part. It was meant to be the start of a movement to change state policies governing where Oregon's energy comes from. A sustainable energy charter has been signed by more than 60 religious leaders and 12 congregations, denominations, and faith-based organizations in Oregon. Once more signatures are gathered, the charter will be delivered to the legislature, said Jenny Holmes of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon.
The state of Oregon has installed a wireless hotspot at Multnomah Falls in the Columbia River Gorge as part of a pilot program to provide access at rest stops, parks, and waysides across Oregon. The falls are one of seven wireless locations so far. Two new hotspots at South Beach State Park at Newport and Dee River Wayside at Lincoln City will come online this month. Free access is limited to sponsored sites such as Oregon State Parks. Access to the rest of the web will cost a fee, but the state hopes that advertising revenue will eventually make it completely free. The most likely users are truckers and the increasing number of recreational vehicle travelers traveling with their laptops.
The Mackenzie River Gathering is one of Oregon's oldest progressive granting organizations. Known as the MRG Foundation, the group offers grants to individuals and nonprofits doing important work around the state. The newest round of grants was recently announced, and it reads like a dictionary of positive action right in our own communities. Here to talk about it is MRG Program Director Anita Rogers. Thanks for coming, Anita.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about how MRG first came together. What's the history of the Mackenzie River Gathering, and what do you do?
Well, the history of the gathering is quite literal to our name. We were actually started as a gathering on the banks of the Mackenzie River in 1976, where two of our founders had inherited wealth that they decided that they wanted to grant out to the community. One of the quotes from one of our founders, Leslie Brocklebank, was that she felt like she wanted to leave her children a better world rather than leave them with a trust fund. So since that time, we've been following a model of activist-led grant-making where the folks who are most affected by the issues that we fund of human rights, environmental protection, and economic justice are the ones who come together to make the decisions about where our money will go.
Tell us about the grant awards that you gave out this season. Who got the funding, and what are they doing with it?
This spring, we just granted out about $200,000 in two different cycles. One of them was our spring funding cycle, which is where the bulk of our money goes. We funded amazing groups here in Portland and throughout the state, groups like Sisters in Action for Power, who are working on public school issues and the No Child Left Behind Act, groups like Portland Jobs with Justice, who is working on creating coalitions between labor and community activists to create economic justice for our city, groups like CAUSA, who has led the immigrant rights organizing throughout the state. So just through the general funding cycle, we funded 23 different groups around the state who are all doing amazing work. Through our peace fund, we just gave out about $50,000 to some, again, just amazing groups. I just have to say, I love my job. I have the best job in the state, in the movement. I get to meet with these different organizations who are doing amazing work all over. Groups like the Cambodian American Community of Oregon, who applied to our peace fund to do work around genocide and healing the wounds from the past genocides of the Khmer Rouge, and also looking forward to how we can effectively stop genocides before they begin in the future. Groups like the Military Families Speak Out, which is a group of military families who are working to end the war and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's awe-inspiring, the work that people are doing, and I think that at MRG we really get to see how all of this work comes together in a really effective way.
Is the nature of these grants in general one-time funding, or are these recurring funds for the operation of these organizations?
At MRG, we like to give groups a lot more leeway than a lot of other foundations do. So we tend to support offer general support so that groups don't have to, you know, create new projects every year. And we tend to support over the long term. A lot of foundations tend to have kind of fads, like one year youth organizing will be really in, or another year immigration rights organizing will be really in. And we like to fund groups for the long haul and provide a steady stream of support for the movement, because change takes time.
Do you have an oversight process to monitor what's being done with the money that you're granting out over time?
Yeah, we do. We have groups submit reports to us, and we meet with groups periodically. And also our activist-led grant-making process really enables us to fund the most effective and cutting-edge work, and take some risks, too, to fund groups that are doing work that hasn't attracted other funding yet, or, you know, new organizations that will end up becoming really strong, effective, larger organizations, but haven't really had a chance yet. So groups like the Western Prison Project, we were one of their first funders, and they've now become a regional organization that has gained national attention on prison justice issues. Other groups like CAUSA, we were one of their first funders, the Rural Organizing Project, things like that. And so our model enables us to fund really effective organizations and provide some oversight so that we know that we're funding groups that are going to be effective in the long run.
Well, say some of the KBOO listeners out there have in mind an organization, or maybe several organizations that they're thinking about that might need funding.
Mm-hmm.
How do they go about applying for the grants, and what are the selection criteria that you use in awarding the grants?
That's a great question. If folks are interested in applying, they should check out our website if they have web access. And our website is www.mrgfoundation.org, or they can give me a call. And our criteria is around social justice, groups that are organizing for social justice or organizing for change. One of our mottos is change, not charity. So that's what we really look for in the groups that we fund.
Well, thank you very much, Anita. That was Anita Rogers, Program Director for the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation. For more information, once again, call 503-289-1517 or go to their website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
Comedy Central's new local news mockumentary, Dog Bites Man, might have bitten off more than it can chew. The network finds itself juggling demands to drop footage from the partly scripted, partly improvisational-style reality show that premiered last week. The 10-episode series about the staff of a dysfunctional morning news show in Spokane, Washington, features segments in which the fictional news team interviews unsuspecting real people, not always to everyone's delight. The Oregon's Attorney Life Media Literacy class at Portland State University. The first letter, sent May 30th, saw no humor in the situation, believing the fake news crew visited PSU on false pretenses on May 16th and demanded that none of the footage be aired. The network was considering the university's demand that the footage be yanked. Last month, the network agreed to not air a segment filmed in March in California, at which Chapman University professor Fred Smoller was an unwitting panelist in what he thought was a discussion on media and politics being filmed for a documentary.
In support of the 25th anniversary of the United Nations International Day of Peace, Pathways to Peace has chosen Ashland, Oregon's award-winning artist Irene Kai's Peace Dove as the new signature image of the Culture of Peace. 1,200 organizations in 100 countries, reaching millions of people engaged in peace-building activities. The International Day of Peace, also known as Peace Day, was established by a United annual opening of the General Assembly every September. In 2001, September 21st was set as the permanent date.
Wastage is the deliberate discarding or reburying of razor clams contrary to sport harvest regulations. Most discarded razor clams die because they are broken, have their necks cut off, or are improperly placed back into the sand. Sport razor clam regulations forbid this. A recent study by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife determined nearly 20% of razor clams dug on Clatsop beaches of the northern Oregon coast were wasted. Staff from ODFW Marine Resources Program in Astoria redug 205 holes and found 39 clams, or 19%, had been wasted. The average size of the wasted clam was about 3.8 inches, and more than 80% had damage that would result in their death. ODFW reminds clam diggers to help ensure future clamming opportunities by keeping a bag limit of 15 clams, regardless of condition, digging their own clams, and having a shellfish license present.
Hundreds of Oregonians have filed a petition with the Oregon Public Utilities Commission to find out if Oregon phone companies turned over the phone records of ordinary citizens to the National Security Agency. There are 1,000 people nationwide and asking for answers. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside reports.
Oregonians want to know if the federal government spied on them. In a petition delivered late Tuesday, almost 2,000 Oregonians are asking the Oregon Public Utilities Commission to find out if Oregon phone companies cooperated with the National Security Agency's information gathering of ordinary citizens. David Fidanke, with the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, says Oregonians want to know about any illegal invasion of privacy.
The thousands of Oregonians who are included in our petition have stepped forward to demand the mentally unconstitutional invasion of privacy.
60,000 people nationwide also filed petitions with their local commissions in federal court this week that the NSA's spying program is unconstitutional and also violates the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. White House officials maintain their anti-terrorism surveillance programs are legal under executive privilege. For KBOO News, I'm Sheila Whiteside reporting.
Two snowy plover chicks hatched at the Oregon Coast Aquarium last week, and two additional eggs are doing well in the incubator. The snowy plover is a native shorebird that lives on the beach year-round. Recent counts indicate only about 100 birds remain on the entire coast of Oregon. The main reason for their declining population is loss of habitat. The new snowy plover exhibit is due to open this summer. The eggs were taken from the inland Summer Lake location because that population is much more stable than the separate endangered coastal population of western snowy plovers.
Africa is coming to Portland thanks to an array of organizations who want residents to find out more about the continent and how they can help out. KBOO's Doug Guidi reports.
Portland will feel more like a day in Nairobi, Kenya, or Harare, Zimbabwe, as the city hosts the Day of the African Child, a day-long celebration honoring the past, present, and future of Africa's children. The Harambee Center is teaming up with the World Forestry Center to bring this event to Portland, which will feature issues concerning Africa's future, educational activities, and African-styled entertainment. Educating the city about the diverse and enriching qualities that makes Africa special will be present with a number of African-born speakers. The gathering will bring attention to what can be done to improve the welfare of children in Africa, who make up between 50-60% of the population. Jackie Goldrick is co-founder and president of the Harambee Center.
We see it as an opportunity, yes, for the education, but also for involvement, for people to get involved. And we also are starting, we have started another sister school project with in Kenya with Westland High School. And I think it's a great opportunity for young people to make a big difference, and this has certainly happened already.
One of the main focuses will be the unfortunate HIV/AIDS crisis that's affected Africa. And according to a UN AIDS report, every day there are an estimated 1,500 new HIV infections among children under the age of 15. 15 million children have lost one or both parents to the disease. However, hope is on the horizon. This in reference to the recent UN AIDS report, finding that in some regions of Africa, infection rates are down, but existing infections hitting Africa's children are still continuing. Hope is what Day of the African Child wants to echo in Portland by emphasizing the difference communities like Portland can make for Africa. Roberta.
The form of action, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, attendees will also have a chance to learn more about Portland's Harambee Center. Day of the African Child will also be full of African-style food and entertainment. African storytelling will be offered for children as well as craft making for them. And the event will give residents a chance to speak and hear from various Native Africans and hear their contributions to the future of Africa. Day of the African Child will be on Saturday, June 17th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Washington's Park World Forestry Center in Portland. For directions, call the World Forestry Center at 503-228-1367. I'm Doug Weedy, KBOO News.
Oregon State Police in Grants Pass received a report of a possible drunken driver traveling northbound on I-5. The cell phone caller told police a car was weaving excessively through traffic and driving up to 75 miles per hour. A state trooper located the vehicle. Police say the driver, 26-year-old Nolani McDonald, claimed she had been cleaning her car with Armor All and was talking on her cell phone. The officer discovered that the interior of the car had been partially cleaned. McDonald was arrested yesterday for reckless driving and three counts of reckless endangerment.
And now, time for another edition of KBOO's homegrown environmental series, Our Backyard, produced and hosted by our dear friend, Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, how the Bush administration is working to reduce the cost of government, even if it means eliminating the only source of critical information about our environment that's, well, priceless. Even the grandest project depends on the success of the smallest components, and it's been said that governing is in the details, and the truth, if it exists, is in the details. The effects of a White House and a majority in Congress who think being environmentally responsible is cutting down national forest land so that political donors can build resorts for the wealthy has been well documented on the KBOO Evening News and here on Our Backyard. Since 2000, when the Supreme Court ruled that George Bush won the election, representatives of businesses and corporations have been appointed to key positions in the very agencies that are charged with regulating these businesses and corporations. The real danger in this check-and-balance free government we currently enjoy, however, comes from the lower-level political appointees, those who are brought in by the agency heads to do the detail work, draft policies, and apply regulations. Most federal agencies have latitude in how they implement the legislation that empowers them, and it's here, in these details, that the real damage is being done. This administration's philosophy of an economy that must constantly expand, no matter the cost to the environment, has manifested itself in many ways. The Forest Service's continued abdication of its responsibility to act as a steward of our national forests has been in the news recently with its plan to log roadless forest land. And now another agency seems to be abandoning the very reason for its existence. The Environmental Protection Agency was established in 1970 in response to growing public demand for cleaner water, air, and land. The EPA was assigned the daunting task of repairing the damage already done to the natural environment and to establish new criteria to guide Americans in making a cleaner environment a reality. It's also responsible for researching and setting national standards for a variety of environmental programs. And a big part of that part of their mission is supported by the EPA Library Network. Established in 1971, the EPA Library Network is composed of libraries and specialized laboratories located throughout the country. This combined network collection contains a wide range of information on environmental protection and management. Some of this information can be found nowhere else and represents a compilation of the most complete environmental data set currently available. Now, proposed budget cuts could cripple the EPA Library Network. A $2 million cut sought by the White House would reduce the 35-year-old EPA Library Network's budget by 80% and force many of its 10 regional libraries to close. That in turn would dramatically reduce access to EPA reports, guidance, and technical documents that are used by the agency's scientific and enforcement staff, as well as private businesses and citizens. These libraries provide documentation for enforcement cases and help EPA staff track new environmental technologies and the health risks associated with dangerous chemicals. They are also the repositories of scientific information that is used to back up the agency's position on new regulations and environmental reports and data and collections of hard-to-find documents of federal Superfund hazardous waste sites, water quality data, and the health of regional ecosystems. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, a nonprofit whistleblower group that first drew attention to the library controversy, obtained internal EPA documents on the proposed cuts. In a statement, they said, "We view this as another example of the Bush administration marginalizing EPA research so that the agency scientists and other specialists can't do their jobs. Then, in the absence of information, plans by industries and others that have environmental implications go forward. The EPA is currently under scrutiny for considering testing pesticides on humans, and a report a few weeks ago suggests that EPA decisions to allow continued use of certain chemicals have been unduly influenced by the chemical manufacturers rather than scientific data. And in an unprecedented action, representatives for thousands of U.S. Environmental Protection Agency scientists are publicly objecting to imminent agency approval for a score of powerful, controversial pesticides. The scientists cite compelling evidence, which EPA leadership is choosing to ignore, that these pesticides damage the developing nervous systems of fetuses, infants, and children. The EPA operates a regional library in Seattle, as well as the Western Ecology Division Library in Corvallis that is doing important research on terrestrial ecosystems, wildlife populations, and the environmental risks of biotechnology to crops and native plants. By saving $2 million, the Bushies claim they're exercising fiscal responsibility, but in reality will be effectively denying public access to some of the most critical environmental data we have, while at the same time they continue to spend billions on the quagmire in Iraq and support tax subsidies and concessions to the global corporate partners. But don't feel helpless, feel outraged. Call Representatives Blumenauer, DeFazio, Hooley, Walden and Wu, and Senators Wyden and Smith. Tell them this penny-wise, pound-foolish budget cut is yet another transparent attack on the environment that serves no one but big business and global corporatism. And in the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
The current time is 5:24. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the federal district judge overseeing the CIA leak case against Scooter Libby held a pretrial status hearing today. China is selling arms to human rights abusers, according to a new Amnesty International report. And hear how a 7-year-old Pennsylvanian has swept the nation with his invention. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
A subcommittee of the House Committee on Homeland Security heard testimony today regarding waste and fraud related to money given to survivors of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. As FSRN's Darby Hickey reports, testimony at the hearing revealed that the lack of oversight within the Federal Emergency Management Agency may have resulted in over $1 billion lost in waste and fraud.
Have you ever experienced bogus addresses before? Have you ever experienced invalid primary residences before? Have you ever experienced duplicative registrations before? I imagine the answer would be yes.
Republican Congressman David Reichert of Washington State became heated while questioning a panel of witnesses testifying on fraud in the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. The focus of the hearing was a report issued yesterday by the Government Accountability Office, which monitors how the government spends money, outlining major problems within FEMA's disaster assistance programs that may have resulted in over $1 billion being lost to waste and fraud. The report alleges that people who are not living in areas affected by the hurricanes received assistance, survivors staying in hotels at FEMA's expense received rental compensation payments as well, emergency assistance money was spent on non-emergency items, and more. Acting Deputy Director of Recovery at FEMA, Donna Daniels, testified.
We have in place now one of the recommendations that the GAO made back in their earlier expedited assistance report. We, in fact, did put in place the identity verification not only on our online registration but also on our 800 registration, so that many of the things that occurred that they have talked about in their report cannot happen now.
Republicans and Democrats on the committee expressed frustration that Deputy Director Daniels was sent to testify instead of the Director of FEMA, R. David Paulison. But while Republicans like Riker and Subcommittee Chair Michael McCall of Texas focused on the actions of FEMA staff members, Ranking Democrat Benny Thompson of Mississippi said the defrauding of FEMA was symptomatic of a larger problem in the leadership of the agency and the Department of Homeland Security.
We're going to talk about symptoms, but I want to talk about the diseases, too. The disease is an agency that for 5 years was weakened by poor leaders, leaders who were chosen based on who they knew and not what they knew.
Thompson and other Democrats sought to expand the discussion beyond individual fraud to wasteful spending by FEMA, including over $90 billion spent on trailers that have not been used and overpaying of contractors for jobs like roof repair, debris removal, and security. Republican chair of the subcommittee, McCall, promised to hold more hearings on the issue in order to improve FEMA's delivery of services while limiting fraud and waste. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Despite record low approval ratings, House lawmakers Tuesday embraced a $3,300 pay raise that will increase their salaries to $168,500. The 2% cost of living raise would be the seventh straight raise for members of the House and Senate. For the second year in a row, lawmakers easily squelched a bid by Representative Jim Matheson, Democrat of Utah, to stop the cost of living raise, which is automatically awarded unless lawmakers vote to block it. The pay raise also applies to the vice president, who is president of the Senate, congressional leaders, and Supreme Court justices. This year, Vice President Dick Cheney, House Speaker Dennis Hastert, and Chief Justice John Roberts received $212,100, Associate Justices receive $203,000, and Senate Party leaders get $183,500. President Bush's salary of $400,000 is unaffected by the legislation.
The CIA has adopted internal rules allowing it to define what constitutes a news organization and what does not. A Washington-based research group contends in a federal lawsuit filed today. The lawsuit by the National Security Archive, which operates the largest non-governmental library of declassified documents, says the spy agency has begun charging illegal search and duplication fees under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. In its lawsuit, the archive said the CIA rejected fee waivers for 42 FOIA requests over the last year, demanding in many cases to know how its requests were related to current events. The delayed FOIA request dealt with issues such as U.S. assistance to Afghan rebels after the 1976 invasion by the Soviet Union and CIA daily briefings with the Truman White House. The CIA told the archive that it wouldn't waive search and duplication fees because many of the requests wouldn't interest the general public.
A panel of three federal judges in San Francisco heard arguments for and against allowing Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in California to test advanced biological weapons without a full environmental impact report. Critics say the government has whitewashed the plan's hazards, but the government contends its environmental assessment was thorough and the plan is safe. FSRN's Ed Rippey reports.
The U.S. government plans to test biological weapons on animals at its nuclear weapons lab in Livermore, California. It prepared an environmental assessment for the plan, which concluded that there was little environmental risk. Activists sued the government, saying that the report did not meet legal standards. They lost and are now appealing. Attorney Stephen Volker summed up their case after the hearing.
In the post-9/11 world we now face, decisions about creating pathogens for which there may not be any cure in a heavily populated area with absolutely no assessment of the risks posed to the public is unconscionable. This government decision is a betrayal of the government's fundamental duty to assure the public's health and safety.
The plaintiffs claimed that the report did not realistically consider the consequences of a terrorist attack, major fire, or explosion at the lab. Marilia Kelly, executive director of Tri-Valley Communities Against a Radioactive Environment, talks about some of the hazards she thinks the report ignored.
The government did a very cursory and inadequate analysis of earthquake risks. The government did a very poor job of looking at things like failure of the filters. In fact, it basically didn't look at that at all in any substantive way. If this facility goes forward without this additional analysis, they will be operating it in a manner that could very well put my community and the greater Bay Area at risk.
Attorney Todd Agard, representing the Department of Energy, said the report considered every point the plaintiffs raised and properly concluded that the biological weapons testing would not endanger the public. He declined to comment for this story, but lab spokesman Steve Wampler said the courts have already proved that the existing assessment is good.
The people who filed the lawsuit may not think that the environmental assessment was done properly, but, you know, at least in the view of the federal district court judge, they're wrong. The federal district court judge decided that the Department of Energy environmental assessment was adequate and basically said that the plaintiffs had no basis for their claim.
The plan for Livermore is the first in a proposed nationwide system of similar testing facilities. An activist said that this decision will set a precedent that will affect many other sites. The Department of Energy has agreed to produce a full environmental impact report for its proposed testing program in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Lulina Miles, staff attorney for Tri-Valley Communities Against a Radioactive Environment, described the larger national plan.
This is not just about bioweapon research at Livermore Lab, but also when this case was initiated, it was about research at both Livermore and Los Alamos nuclear weapons labs. At this point in time, the Department of Energy is talking about putting in yet another bio lab out here in Tracy, California. And if you look more carefully, they have plans on many other sites within the United States nuclear weapons complex.
The plaintiffs expect the court to decide the case in July. In San Francisco, this is Ed Rippey for Free Speech Radio News.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in federal court today demanding more information about a Defense Department database that collected information on anti-war groups and U.S. citizens. The lawsuit asks that the Defense Department turn over records it collected in its TALON database, a system developed by the Air Force in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, as a way to collect information about possible terrorist threats here at home. Anti-war groups and other organizations, including the American Friends Service Committee, protested after it became public that the military had monitored anti-war activities, organizations, and individuals who attended peace rallies. Defense Department spokesman Commander Greg Hicks said the Pentagon would not comment on a pending lawsuit.
The current time is 5:33, and now time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you assume that the jury's recent conviction of Enron CEO Kenneth Lay will chasten America's top execs and dampen their autocratic arrogance, you have not met Bob Nardelli. He's CEO of the Home Depot chain, and he's become notorious for both a bloated ego and a bloated paycheck. In his five-year tenure as Home Depot's chief, Bob has raked in $245 million in personal pay, while the company's shareholders have seen the value of their stock fall by 12%. In contrast, Home Depot's chief rival, Lowe's Inc., has seen its stock price go up by 185% in that time, yet Lowe's CEO was paid only a fraction of what Nardelli hauled off. So shareholders, for whom Bob technically works, went to Home Depot's recent annual meeting to demand that they be given a say in setting the CEO's future pay. Some waved protest signs saying, "Hey, Nardelli, your stock price turned to jelly." Others branded him an OP CEO, overpaid CEO. Did Bob humbly try to make amends with his corporation's owners? Ha! That's about as likely as a hog learning table manners. Instead, he insolently thumbed his nose at them, refusing to let shareholders ask any general questions and offering no response to the few shareholders who were allowed to speak about the pay proposal. After only 30 minutes, Nardelli declared the proposal dead, abruptly gaveled the annual meeting closed, and rushed off to the airport. Representative Barney Frank has introduced a bill to cool such high-handed executive arrogance. Corporate lobbyists, of course, opposed the bill, claiming it could, quote, very well be destabilizing to corporate decision-making. This is Jim Hightower saying, I would hope so. It's time to give shareholders some real say over OP CEOs like Nardelli. For information, call Frank's office, 202-225-5931. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6, hear Hole in the Bucket. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, overcast and cool, lows in the mid and upper 50s, chance of rain 80%, so let's just go ahead and say it's going to rain. Tomorrow it'll be mostly cloudy again, with showers possible in the morning, highs 65 to 70, and the chance of rain 20%. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
After returning from his surprise visit to Iraq, President Bush said at a press conference today that politics are not the mercy of the war in Iraq. Bush said he, quote, to make decisions not based on politics, but based on what is best for the United States of America. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives is preparing for a full day of debate on the war of Iraq tomorrow. But as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, some members might not participate, saying the resolution they are forced to debate is misguided and politically motivated.
About a third of the House of Representatives has been pushing for a debate on the war in Iraq. They will get what they asked for tomorrow, in which all day will be dedicated to the war. But some lawmakers plan to boycott tomorrow's debate. Paul Jones, Republican from Texas.
If this resolution comes to the floor, I will not participate.
And Neil Abercrombie, Democrat from Hawaii.
Because it lends credence to that we're having a debate, and a lot of discussion play back and forth with the fiction people are tuning into it or observing it, that we'd actually be voting on things that we're not going to do that at all. My suggestion is the Democratic caucus, and for those who wish to join our Republicans, we all step careful and indicate that we want to have a sensitive debate on this and to make suggestions how might deal with questions or elsewhere.
They and other lawmakers say the context of the scheduled debate is irrelevant. Representative Ike Skelton, Democrat from Missouri and ranking member of the Armed Services Committee.
I'm deeply disturbed that the resolution that will be before us attempts to confuse two wars. The war in Afghanistan, which is the war against terrorists. Terrorism had its genesis there. We did the right thing, of course, by going in there and fighting terrorism around the world, Al-Qaeda and their minions. And the second war is the war in Iraq. These are insurgents, guerrillas. Their goal is not like the same as a terrorist to create a fundamentalist Muslim caliphate all across the Middle East. Their goal is different. The insurgents want to topple the existing government in Iraq and establish their own.
The Republican written resolution declares that the United States will win the global war on terror and also the struggle to protect freedom from the terrorist adversary. According to House rules, the Democrats are not allowed to offer their own version. Speaker Nasser Flanoy says that terrorists are in Iraq.
What we're fighting Iraq today, Al-Qaeda, and in the war, and we will stand up a free Iraq, a democratic Iraq. We will stand up troops of Iraqi nationality and a police force. And as that happens, we'll be able to bring our troops home, but not until we do that.
When a reporter asked if Al-Qaeda would be in Iraq if the U.S. had never occupied the country, Hastert dismissed the question as speculation.
We don't know, but the fact is we are fighting this war against the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I'd rather be fighting it there than in the streets of Washington or New York City or Chicago, Illinois.
Marty Meehan, Democrat from Massachusetts, says the real issue is being avoided, and the resolution supports the status quo.
So I think at a minimum, with a situation deteriorating, with insurgencies that are growing, we ought to have an honest, candid discussion about the challenges that we face in Iraq and what we are going to do to change policy to meet those challenges.
Meanwhile, in the Senate, Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts plans to introduce his resolution to set a timeline and a deadline to withdraw. The Democratic leadership plans to offer a separate amendment that urges the president to come up with an exit plan. Peace groups have called for a national call-in campaign for today and tomorrow for people to call their senators to urge a withdrawal of U.S. troops. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As the war in Iraq continues for its fourth year, the global image of America has slipped yet further, even amongst people in some countries closely allied with the United States, a new Washington-based Pew Research Center poll has found. Countries where positive views drop significantly include Spain, 23% down from 41%, India, 56% down from 71%, Russia, 43% down from 52%, and Indonesia, now at 30% down from 38%. In Turkey, only 12% said they had a favorable opinion, down from 23% last year. Other declines were less steep in France, Germany, and Jordan, while people in China and Pakistan had a slightly more favorable image of the United States this year than last. Support for the fight against terrorism led by the United States is also down, Pew found. Many respondents distinguished between their largely negative feelings about President Bush and their feelings about Americans in general. Majorities in 7 of 14 countries polled, not including the United States, had favorable views of Americans, led by Japan at 82% and Britain at 69%, but majorities in just 2 countries, India and Nigeria, expressed confidence in Bush.
Several Palestinian employees broke into the building of the Palestinian Legislative Council today during a parliamentary session in the West Bank city of Ramallah in protest of unpaid salaries. FSRN's Manar Jabrin reports.
Around 165,000 public employees have not received paychecks for the last 4 months due to an ongoing financial crisis. A Middle East quartet meeting scheduled for today had been expected to approve urgent measures to free up funds to pay Palestinian salaries. However, the United States, which is a party to the quartet, recently cancelled the talks. Salaries have not been paid to Palestinian civil servants since the Hamas-led government came to power in January, and the European Union has been urgently trying to work out a payment system that would ease the humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian territories. The United States has stopped aid from being channeled through Arab banks by warning them of possible penalties. On Tuesday, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni said Israel will decide whether to release tens of millions of dollars of Palestinian money generated through tax revenues that have been withheld since the election of Hamas into the international aid plan to Palestinians once the plan is completed. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
In Ottawa, Canada, hearings at the Supreme Court continued today to rule on the constitutionality of Canada's controversial security certificates. A measure that allows authorities to indefinitely detain any non-citizen suspected of being a threat to national security under secret evidence and without access to a fair trial. Aaron Lekoff has more from Montreal.
Banners and signs denouncing arbitrary detentions, racism, and xenophobia covered the front lawn of the Supreme Court of Canada in Ottawa on Tuesday. Inside, hearings were getting underway to challenge the constitutionality of the security certificate, a measure that the Canadian Border Services Agency uses to lock up any non-citizen they accuse of having terrorist links. The security certificates are a measure of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. They can be signed against someone to detain them indefinitely, without access to a fair trial, under secret evidence, and with no appeal. Outside, protesters from Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto, and beyond gathered in what they are calling Camp Hope. They will maintain a presence during the 3-day-long hearing as they call for the abolition of the certificates and justice for the detainees. Adil Sharkawi, a Moroccan-born Montreal resident, was detained for nearly 2 years before being released in February 2005 under heavy bail conditions. Sharkawi launched the Supreme Court challenge shortly after his arrest in May 2003, and the court finally agreed to hear it in September 2005. He traveled to Ottawa to attend the hearings.
We are here after 3 years of struggling because we want justice. To be released with those conditions, it's not a justice. I'm here like an immigrant, like an Arab, like a Muslim, and I'm asking the same rights like any Canadian, like any human being.
This appearance marked the first time since Sharkawi's release that he was permitted to leave the Montreal region, and he is still under curfew without access to a phone or the internet. There are currently 4 men being held under security certificates in Canada, all of them Muslim or Arab. One of them, Mohammed Harkat, has just been granted bail conditions similar to Sharkawi's and is expected to return home to Ottawa in days. The other 3, recently transferred to a special facility dubbed Guantanamo North near Kingston, Ontario, are on a hunger strike which began 3 weeks ago. Mona Elfouli, the wife of security certificate detainee Mohammed Majoub, explains the toll that her husband's action has taken on her family.
It is completely stressful, fearing of him, like, you know, dying out of this. He's striking on the conditions on going on in the detention itself. And, you know, it's really affecting me, and not only me, the children.
Jim Loney is with the Christian Peacemaker team. He was held as a hostage in Iraq for 4 months earlier this year.
For me, this is important, that these men who are being detained, it's not just them, but there's families and loved ones, and it's having a huge impact. And they're not just faceless, abstract characters. They're real flesh and blood people. And we want to call attention to these security certificate detentions are causing a lot of suffering.
Loney led a demonstration in Ottawa on Monday with Mona El-Fouli and others victimized by Canada's security policies to demand a meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. So far, their demands for a fair trial and due process have gone unheard, but hope remains a constant as the Supreme Court hearings continue until Thursday. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal, Quebec.
A survey of public servants in South Africa suggests that 40% mistakenly believe HIV/AIDS is curable. The report carried out by the University of South Africa includes interviews with people responsible for implementing HIV/AIDS programs. About 30% of government departments were found to have no policies or programs in place to deal with the epidemic. The findings come less than 2 weeks after the United Nations General Assembly criticized South Africa for not doing enough to tackle AIDS.
Indonesia's volatile volcano Mount Merapi nearly smothered a village with a cloud of searing gas during an eruption Wednesday, forcing thousands of residents to evacuate just one day after people returned home after officials had lowered alert levels. The alert level for Mount Merapi was raised to its highest status again, and it dumped thick ash on scores of houses. The head of the government's Volcanology and Disaster Mitigation Center says the situation is life-threatening. Several buildings near the peak had been incinerated, and many families have been reported missing. Scientists speculated that the volcano was calming down after weeks of activity. The alert level was dropped Tuesday, allowing people who had spent weeks in evacuation camps to return home. Mount Merapi spewed hot clouds and ash that covered a village 4 miles away with a gray blanket an inch thick as soot rained down across many districts. Despite the danger, many people have stayed put over the last month, citing the need to guard their homes and look after crops and animals. At least 20,000 people live in the danger zone, where farmers benefit from rich volcanic soil.
African heads of state have vowed to do more to help millions of subsistence farmers improve their yields. At the end of Africa's first agricultural summit in Abuja, the leaders say they wanted to see the cost of fertilizers reduced so that poor soil can be rejuvenated and food production boosted across the continent. They say this could lead to a new, quote, green revolution in agriculture, referring to technical advances in the 1950s, such as the introduction of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and improved irrigation. Though yields grew in many countries worldwide, the intensive farming techniques favored by the green revolution have been criticized for encouraging a loss of biodiversity and increasing pollution through excess fertilizer and pesticide use.
In an effort to stop what it calls deceptive marketing by the baby media industry, the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood has launched a complaint with the Fair Trade Commission against a television channel called Baby First TV. The complaint cites a lack of evidence that television is beneficial for babies and growing concern that it may be harmful. Baby First TV, the first television station for infants and toddlers, is offered on DirecTV. The group is asking for a warning label on the channel's programs, including the American Academy of Pediatrics' recommendation of no screen time for children under two. In an amendment to their May 11, 2006 complaint against Baby Einstein and Brainy Baby, the Commercial-Free Childhood Campaign charged Baby First TV with violating Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act by marketing their programming as educational for babies.
Law enforcers have counted more than 180 deaths in the year since tasers came into widespread use to stun suspects. Now the government says it's time to do an official safety review. Stun guns have soared in popularity as the so-called non-lethal alternative to bullet-firing guns. But some suspects do die after being shocked by the electronic control devices. The Justice Department's research arm counts 184 such deaths, most of them since 2000. Amnesty International has called for a moratorium on stun gun use, saying its tally comes to about 160 deaths in the past 5 years. Officials say the study won't look at whether the stun guns were used appropriately. They'll only make medical assessments in the instances where the weapons were used.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, let's call it 14th, 2006. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our Associated Press Wire editors are Lynn Mollick and Eve Sokolai. Tonight's audio editor is Joshua Eigen. Special thanks to reporters Doug Guidi, Edison Carter, and Sheila Whiteside. Our engineer is Jacob Fenston. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afif Ahmed Shafi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with Joanne Bowman. At 9, it's Teresa Mitchell with Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, hear Oregon Issues with host Dave Mazza. At 10, DIY Portland with Julie Sabatier features sounds from this year's Village Building Convergence. At 10:30, local artist Tom Kramer hosts Art Focus. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your community nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 14th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In southwest Colorado, the Navajo Nation issued a second state of emergency Tuesday as the Navajo Mountain Fire burned 1,000 acres and a total of 6 fires that started over the weekend were contained. A press release issued by the Navajo Nation says over 33 people were evacuated from their homes at Pine Springs Monday when the 50-acre fire moved close to houses. The Pine Springs School opened its doors to feed evacuees and fire crews. About a half dozen people were housed there overnight, according to Principal Luann Jones. Information Officer Selena Manychildren says all but one of the fires burning across the nation were caused by lightning strikes, and the second state of emergency was issued because of continuing drought conditions. Manychildren says there has been a lot of assistance in containing the fires.
The fire crews are through the BIA, and their equipment, heavy equipment through the BIA, the Navajo Nation Forestry, surrounding areas like law enforcement through the nation, Navajo Nation, and then the Navajo Nation Rangers and Apache County have been on the scene here to assist. Even the Hopi tribe have been sending their fire engines to assist.
Manychildren estimates that more than 3,700 acres had burned across the Navajo Nation as of Tuesday evening, including areas near Window Rock, Arizona. In other news, the Sea Alaska Native Corporation has been quick to take advantage of new federal legislation that makes it easier to issue stock to people born after 1971, when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The law that created Sea Alaska and a dozen other regional corporations limited shareholders to eligible natives born before December 19, 1971. Some descendants have won stock through inheritance, but other descendants can only be given stock through a vote by existing shareholders. Sea Alaska's board has tried unsuccessfully to add later generations to the shareholder rolls through such a vote. But so far, they have not been able to win the supermajority of all possible shareholder ballots required by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Recent changes to that act dropped the requirement to a simple majority of those attending a meeting in person or by proxy. Spokesman Todd Andioquia says Sea Alaska's board has scheduled such an election for next year.
Shareholders will be voting on whether or not to enroll shareholder descendants into the corporation. And that will be at the 2007 annual meeting. So we'll be spending the next year in a educational campaign to help shareholders better understand, you know, the pros and cons of enrolling descendants and give them a chance to make an informed decision on which way to vote.
Shareholders heard about Sea Alaska's business performance at Saturday's annual meeting. The corporation made about $25 million in net profits last year, up from about $15 million the previous year. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Later this month, spiritual leaders from 5 Northwest tribes will come together to say goodbye to some of their ancestors for the second time. Correspondent Elizabeth Wynn Johnson explains.
Ritual reburials are a common occurrence for Indian tribes. Countless sacred sites have been disturbed in the name of development and scientific inquiry. Nez Perce Council member Brooklyn Baptiste says each reburial brings closure, but it's also a reminder.
It baffles me as much as society at some point doesn't think of us as equals, you know,
if I was to go up and dig your grandmother up in her grave and study her, you wouldn't be too happy about that.
An upcoming reburial in North Idaho is notable for both its size and its scope. Along with the Nez Perce, it includes the Wanapum, Yakima, Umatilla, and Colville Confederated tribes. Hundreds of individual graves and thousands of artifacts were unearthed near the Snake River in 1964. They've been sitting in boxes at Washington State University and the University of Idaho ever since. The repatriation process will include songs of tribute and traditional protocols that Baptiste hopes will restore their peace.
We honor the relatives and we apologize for having to do this once when it had already been done.
The tribes are keeping mum on the details of the ceremony, including when and where it will take place. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson in Coeur d'Alene.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 3 minutes to 6 p.m. Please do stay tuned for Hole in the Bucket.